days, I'm going to walk out of the house. I hope you will not blame me and you will support me. His answer to her regret was, this is a problem between you and Dad. Don't get me involved. It really broke her heart. And she said all this while she's been living in the home for the son. Yeah. And now with him saying this few words to her, she was really very disappointed.
So what do you think were Shu Wei's beliefs though?
At workshops run by advocacy groups like AWARE, gender stereotypes are being questioned.
You should be submissive.
I accept.
You should be a housewife.
You should be able to cook.
It's your job to look after the children.
You should keep the family together.
I accept.
Breadwinner.
I accept.
Macho.
You shouldn't cry.
I accept.
You're always right.
Whoa. I accept.
You are a role model.
I accept.
Without a shift in societal attitudes, responses to domestic abuse remain unchanged.
There are three typical responses when a person is confronted with domestic violence. One is to deny that it exists. Turn the other way. Don't deal with it. The other is to acknowledge it exists, but to minimize it. To say that this is a once-off thing. To say that it only affects the poorer community, the less educated, the migrants. And when these two initial responses isn't adequate, the third response is always to blame the victim.
Hearts, minds, attitudes. These are the keys to shaping a better future.
So you can do case management till the cows come home. Every case, you empower the woman, you give her all her options, and then she finds a solution, right? But it just keeps happening. So until you try to change, until you change the societal attitudes, it's going to continue, and you're just going to have cases continue all the time. Yeah, so we really have to, even though it's long term, it might take 10 years, even more, but we have to start somewhere. Yeah. So this is the driving force behind the weekend campaign. It's the first time that we're actually doing a campaign that lasts more than a year, but we think this is necessary, right? So we plan for at least a 3-year campaign, and we say, if it has to be a community effort, right? So we are really just a catalyst. We provide the tools, and we try to inspire people to think about the problem and how they themselves can be part of the solution.
I would like to encourage others to not submit to other people's expectations of you.
My change is to remind people of their freedom of choice and their right to choose.
My change is to start believing in my self-worth. Then I think I can help others believe in themselves as well.
Mine was not a physical abusive relationship, but it was more mental and psychological that slowly deteriorated my sense of self-worth over that 24 period time frame. So I think that what, as a woman, I would like to do is reclaim my sense of self-worth and then teach my daughters what it means to be a powerful woman.
When I share my story, you know, people will say things like, what did you do? Did you do something to make him behave that way, you know? There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know. And the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know. But I'm very fortunate in a way that my children are very supportive of what I do. They are very proud of the work I do, you know. The more I see this, the more I feel that, you know, I should share that there's really nothing wrong in facing our demons, you know, straight on.
Mira, too, is no longer a victim.
Every day for the rest of my life, when I look into the mirror, I'm going to see that scar. But it's a scar that will tell me that I tried. I tried really hard. I got into a relationship eyes wide open with hope. However, I used to look at it and cry. Not anymore. I look at it and I feel brave about it and I tell myself I survived. I survived because of very strong family support, really good strong friends who made sure that I was going to be strong, accepted me, allowed me to cry. I came out of a toxic marriage. Today, if I see a woman get beat up by a man, I will go and help the woman. I don't care how big that guy is gonna be. I don't care if that guy is gonna use vulgarities on me, but I would go rescue that woman.
Today, Rachel proudly stands her ground and openly tells her story so that other women don't have to face the same ordeal alone.
Is there any other point?
You always feel that, you know, why is this happening to me, you know, especially when you look around and, you know, people are having happy marriages, happy families, you know. And you will feel like, you know, you're so alone in the world, you know, that it's only happening to you. And that's the reason why I'm speaking out about this, you know, so that other women will know that it is not only just happening to them.
Breaking the suffocating silence is the first step in ending the issue of domestic violence and abuse. Women enduring such horrific conditions must find the courage and strength to speak out and seek help. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3rd, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. The Holy Quran addresses the leaders of the Kuffar and their followers in a different manner.
In one ayah, the Holy Quran describes these people as the Imams of Kufr. Fight you, the Imams of Kufr, for their oaths are nothing to them. The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 12. In one part of Surah Al-Qasas, God describes them as leaders inviting to the fire. And we made them leaders inviting to the fire, and on the day of judgment, no help shall they find. Chapter 28, verse 41. They drag the people into hell. In fact, the severity with which the Holy Quran describes the enemies of Islam and of the Kuffar is related to these orientations. All other people from among the Kuffar, those who seek and cherish the truth and who do not show hostility, are the addressees of that beautiful and holy ayah. It grieves him that you should perish. Today, the enemy of Islam, the main enemy, those leaders inviting to the fire, is arrogance and Zionism. It is they who are confronting and fighting against Islam with all their power. The last display of this confrontation is the one that unfortunately took place in Paris last week. That indecent show that was performed in Paris is really noteworthy and significant.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
What kind of government is the French government? What policy does it have? This policy is the same policy that has offered shelter to the most violent and savage terrorists in the world, the terrorists who martyred a president in our country and his prime minister. They martyred the head of the judiciary branch, many members of parliament and executive and judiciary officials. According to the figures that are available, they also martyred about 17,000 ordinary people on the streets and in the bazaars. They're not ordinary terrorists, and they have sought shelter in France and Paris. That is why the French claim to be supporting human rights and freedom. The same government offered the most help to a bloodthirsty wolf named Saddam.
Alhamdulillah.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. More victims of the U.S.-led coalition of war on terror are being identified. This time, 39 Afghan civilians who were killed in 2002 are most likely to have been killed illegally by Australian Special Forces. Now, this is according to a four-year investigation by Australian Defence Force after complaints by Afghan and Australian nationals to investigate. So what does it all mean now? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian Special Forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry carried out by the Australian Defence Force reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian armed forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging in a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out initial research into the atrocities believes that they were called deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crimes. The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during a period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention. Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalist who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London and journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start off in London with Jonathan. What did you think about the findings of this investigation, and were you surprised at all that these type of abuses had taken place?
Obviously, the reports are very shocking indeed. Even though it was somewhat redacted, there's enough information in there to really raise huge questions over the whole nature of the operations of the special forces of the Australian Army in Afghanistan. The good thing is the report has come out, and also that the head of the Defence Services has apologised, But of course, an apology is nothing like enough. There will be prosecutions, and that must be prosecutions. But it shouldn't only be the younger soldiers who end up being prosecuted, because I think clearly the command chain goes higher, including perhaps into the political sphere of the leadership in Australia, and there needs to be a very, very careful investigation as to exactly how this sort of policy came about, where, as was mentioned in the introductory piece, for example, there would be what was called blooding. Young recruits just arriving would be told to shoot a prisoner in order to get them used to killing civilians, which is clearly a war crime.
Well, Brett, in the report it states about that war culture that our guest in London just was mentioning amongst these elite troops, and the way some troops were anxious to get their first kill. What exactly does that say? I mean, does it appear to you that this would just be something isolated, and these troops were not following orders? Do you think this is just isolated with these individuals, or do you think that the responsibility goes further up the ladder?
I think it definitely runs further than just the rank-and-file troops that have committed these atrocities. Indeed, as has been mentioned and was written in the report, in many cases, these were initiation rituals of a kind. You know, young soldiers, grunts who come into combat for the first time, who are being told to basically get their hands dirty immediately in one of the most gruesome ways possible by murdering either civilians or unarmed prisoners. And, of course, this order had to come from someone, and so this order came most likely from the officers, and the officer staff, of course, responds to an even higher brass of higher officers and higher ups. That I think it's very unlikely, if this was such a relatively commonplace occurrence as seems to be hinted in the report, it would be very unlikely that the higher brass did not know about this, and that the military leadership was in the dark about this. And I think this is, on the contrary, this speaks to a very typical and very problematic culture of extreme nationalism and jingoism in not just Australia, not Australia in particular even, but in the Western armed forces that have been active in the Middle East in general and in Central Asia in the past few decades. This is a typical sort of mentality that you see also expressed in the United States military, I believe also in the British military, and in many of the troops that and armies in general, army command structures of the nations that are active in the conflict in, for example, Afghanistan, but also in Iraq. Because what you see is a form of result, what I would call a result of decades of massive propaganda, of dehumanization of the enemy, and not just of the enemy, but of the people living in the country. Mm-hmm. This is no longer crimes committed against people who fought necessarily against these troops. These are not just Taliban soldiers or Daesh or whatever extremists that are being targeted. These are very often civilians. There have been numerous cases of footage being published in which soldiers, usually American soldiers, are traveling through the countryside in Afghanistan and just murdering some farmers or some goat herders or shepherds along the way, because they know that there is very little chance of this really going viral, let's say, because for them these are just illiterate peasants that they mm-hmm. can do with whatever they want. This is a problem of mentality, a problem of mindset
okay.
that's all pervasive even the military structure of many Western societies.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you think in general this U.S.-led coalition, and in this case we're talking about the Australian side of things, but in general that, as our other guest was alluding to, that they have this superiority type of attitude when dealing with the other, especially, for example, dealing with Afghans, and basically not even looking at these people as human sometimes?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. Brett is absolutely correct to focus on the dehumanization of the other in these sorts of conflict situations. The fact that they're of different ethnicity, the fact that they are Muslims in most cases, also plays into this narrative of some countries, including the United States, that see them therefore as the enemy, whether they are actually armed resistance or terrorists or just ordinary farmers going about their own business. And there seems to have been such an acceptance of that situation in Afghanistan, by no means only by the Australians, that poor Afghans who were confronted with these sorts of situations often didn't even complain because they thought it would be a complete waste of time, that there was a culture of impunity, and well-armed Westerners, whether they were Australians, Americans, or indeed British, would always be able to have their way, and that the best way to escape problems was to remain quiet and out of sight. So there is a real problem, and it's not only in Afghanistan. We saw incidents like that in Iraq as well. For example, the way that Americans treated people in Abu Ghraib prison, you may recall, appalling scenes of degradation and dehumanization. And this is something that really Western countries, including Britain, have got to come to terms with and to stamp out.
Well, Brett, the acts that, actually crimes that we're talking about happened 18 years ago. Why do you think it's taken so long to expose this when Afghan families have been complaining from the very beginning about the abuses of U.S.-led coalition forces there?
Well, I think it's a combination of general problems, of course, getting information like this out to the world, but combined with a far more important and far more destructive problem being the policy of keeping a lid on everything. As has been said in the beginning of the report, indeed, by the reporter on the scene, is that when ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reported on this in 2017 in the first place, their offices were raided, and the journalist was, for a while, threatened basically to be treated as, for example, Julian Assange or Edward Snowden were when they basically blew a whistle on certain crimes that were being committed in the country or by people of the country's nationality. So this is, when you see that this is how far they will go in broad daylight in Australia already, you can only begin to imagine how far they will go in order to keep this under, to swipe this under the rug when it's being said in Afghanistan. You can imagine if a farmer or a shepherd in Afghanistan goes to complain to the authorities, to the police forces, even if it's the Afghan local authorities, the chances are very high, of course, that this complaint will be noticed by the occupying forces, the foreign forces that are being talked about, in this case, the Australians. So, of course, there is no evidence of a violent crackdown on people who are trying to explain their story. But I don't think it would be very far-fetched to believe that these people are likely threatened with violence, threatened with more dangerous acts if they try to get their story known. And indeed, as Mr. Fryer said, the problem is that many of these people, after a while, probably just gave up trying to complain about it in general, because what's the point of trying to get your story out if you know the lid will be trying to, they will try to put the lid on it constantly. And that result is that, fortunately, we have had some good journalists now, Australian journalists, who have finally decided to publish the story. But it will, of course, it has taken years for these people to dig through the mud in order to get what they needed in order to publish this report. That's the result of it.
Right. And Jonathan, at the end of the day, do you think that any measures will really be taken against these soldiers? Will these soldiers be charged with murder, you think?
Well, I think certainly there will be prosecutions. Whether they will be found guilty and sentenced to long periods of prison is another matter. But I think there certainly will be prosecutions. It would be very difficult for the Australian government to avoid putting some troops on trial because of the public opinion and international opinion, which would demand that some people have to bear responsibility. As I mentioned earlier, the problem is how high up the line should this go? Because obviously the higher it goes, then the less likelihood there is of any proper retribution against the people who are responsible for the policy, which does stem into the whole of the war of terror, war on terror narrative. In other words, that if you're in a situation where you're dealing against with terrorists, that anything goes, and that means that ordinary civilians who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with any extreme group, get caught up in this. So I think it's very important for international law that Australia takes a stand and that other countries, including Britain, also look at their own special forces and really see whether this problem is wider and whether how it can be rooted out.
Well, Brett, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison now has apologized directly to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani about what he called these abuses. But what does that mean at the end of the day? What do you think is going to happen?
Of course, the problem is that it's very easy to apologize for something that happened. The question here is, of course, if you not just, talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And that's something that Australia has to prove now. They have to show to the world that they take this seriously, that these people will be tried for the crimes that they have committed. And indeed, this in many cases, this would definitely include the charge of murder or at least manslaughter, and not just, crimes that, not just like abuses that were committed in the time of war, because that makes it sound like there are circumstances that would justify these actions. And I don't think these things are justifiable, no matter under which circumstances they happen. The other problem, of course, is the question remains how far Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, will go in order to pursue this, because we have seen time and again that the Afghan government is not always necessarily a stable government, and is in many cases and in many ways very dependent, of course, on these foreign troops that are keeping it in power. There is a problem of popular support that is very much lacking, popular support for this government. And as a result, it is very difficult, I think, for it is very unlikely, to hope that these Afghan politicians will really try to pressure what they perceive as their Western allies into really pursuing this very much. Of course, I could be mistaken, and I hope I will be. But this goes much further than just apologizing and saying sorry that this happened. These people have to be brought to justice. Recompensation should be paid to the families of the victims. And in general, actually, recompensation should be paid to Afghanistan, because this is running into their hundreds of billions of dollars that Afghanistan has been suffering in both economic terms and, of course, in manpower and in population, a lot of people that have been massacred as a result of this unnecessary war ever since 2001. Mm-hmm. So this is a general problem that has to be solved in a way that is much more fundamental. And that is something in which I fear that is unlikely to happen, because if we bring it back to the leader of this coalition, the United States, we have to bear in mind the United States has never even recompensated Vietnam for the crimes they had committed there 40, 50 years ago. So right. the chances that they could do this anytime soon to Afghanistan are, I'm afraid, quite slim.
Well, Jonathan, are there double standards in the way U.S. allies are held responsible for war crimes as opposed to those fighting against the U.S.?
Well, a war crime is a war crime, whoever carries it out, whether it's the U.S. or any of their allied forces in a country like Afghanistan or any extremist group. In the news bulletin, you mentioned today's attacks from Daesh on Kabul, again, yet more civilians killed in that attack. And certainly they need to be held to account as well, but it's much more difficult because, of course, you can't often identify where is the chain of command and who are really carrying out these atrocities. But the whole idea of setting up the International Criminal Court several years ago, which Trump so dislikes, is the idea that there are international standards, and these should apply to governments, to armies, and to non-state actors. And it's very important, I think, that this principle be bolstered by appropriate judicial action, and that the climate of impunity in a war situation is removed, because surely in the 21st century we should have realized that it's no longer possible to justify many things which perhaps our ancestors considered perfectly normal, but which we don't.
Which we don't. What do you think about that, Brett? The things that ancestors didn't consider normal, but which we don't. However, if we look at the world of 2020 and we see the imbalance of it all, how much have we progressed? When we look at this situation, at the end of the day, don't you think, according to international standards, that the life of an Afghan is not going to be held the same as for as an American soldier being killed or an Aussie soldier being killed or a Brit being killed on the ground? Isn't there a difference when we see terrorist attacks and how we react when they're committed in Afghanistan as opposed to a terrorist attack in Europe or some of these other Western countries?
Yeah, this is, I believe that is undeniably true. There is a massive amount of hypocrisy in general, in international media, mainstream media mostly, in international politics, even in international diplomacy. There is a massive issue that we have, what we have seen over and over again, that when a terrorist attack happens, for example, in Brussels or in Paris, this is worldwide news. This goes on to dominate world politics for years sometimes. Whereas these sort of attacks that have been taking place, for example, in Paris, they happen on a weekly basis in some areas in the Middle East, for example. And in many cases, those same sort of attacks of that magnitude are being committed by the Western powers that are mourning the attacks that are taking place in the West. Now, the problem is that there is this indeed this massive double standard that unfortunately has seeped very much into the ICC as well. The ICC has been doing, definitely been doing some good work ever since it was founded, undeniably so. But there is as well, an undeniable focus on certain third world leaders of certain third world countries. There is a reason why in some regions of Africa, the ICC is jokingly called the International Caucasian Court, because it's something that, it's a court that is perceived as a very Eurocentric court that specifically targets leaders of in Africa, mostly, or in Yugoslavia, be leaders of third world countries, of countries that are not part of the hegemonic powers, and that these people, for their crimes or perceived crimes, are being dragged to The Hague in order to be tried. But it's very almost unheard of to see this pressure, the same sort of status, the same sort of rules being applied to people and rulers of first world countries. For example, you know, George W. Bush, for example, the crimes committed by President Obama, who even received the Nobel Peace Prize right before he went on to, you know, murder people in Syria and in Libya. So this is there is a massive hypocrisy at play here that is embedded in a way, of course, in the United Nations very often, in the veto power being wielded by certain permanent members of the Security Council.
All right. And on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. According to a new analysis, nearly 12 million jobless Americans would lose federal benefits the day after Christmas unless Congress passes extensions for key unemployment programs. Currently, there are two active key government programs authorized by the Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act, but both expire on 26th of December. One program is the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which provides unemployment aid to freelance and temporary workers. According to a study by the Century Foundation, if it expires, 7.3 million workers would lose their benefits. The study shows the other program is Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, which if expires, would deprive 4.6 million workers of their needed income. We now present you an article written by Christopher Rugeber. The piece is titled, U.S. Jobless Claims Rise to Nearly 745,000, Millions to Lose Aid. The article has been taken from the website of the Associated Press. Stay with us for more of Christopher Rugeber's article. The number of Americans seeking unemployment aid rose recently to about 745,000, the first increase in 5 weeks, and a sign that the resurgent viral outbreak is likely slowing the economy and forcing more companies to cut jobs. The worsening pandemic and the arrival of cold weather could accelerate layoffs in the weeks ahead. Of the roughly 20 million Americans now receiving some form of unemployment benefit, about half will lose those benefits when two federal programs expire at the end of this year. Rubila Faruqi, chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics, a forecasting firm, said, "The risk of further job cuts and income loss is high now from business operations being curtailed." She added, "Also, expiration of federal benefits later this year will put renewed strain on household incomes. Overall, the labor market remains under stress." The U.S. Labor Department's report on Thursday, 19th of November, showed that applications for jobless aid rose from 711,000 in the previous week. In March, when the pandemic first intensified, the number had soared to 6.9 million. Before then, applications typically hovered about 225,000 a week. The surge in confirmed viral infections and worry about its effect on the economy are putting pressure on the financial markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average declined in early trading on Thursday, 19th of November, for a third consecutive day. The economy's modest recovery is increasingly at risk, with newly confirmed daily infections in the U.S. having exploded 80% over the recent weeks to the highest levels on record. More states and cities are issuing face mask mandates, limiting the size of public gatherings, restricting restaurant dining, closing gyms, or reducing the hours and capacity of stores and other businesses. At least 15 states have tightened curbs on businesses to try to slow the spread of the infection. Evidence is emerging that consumers are losing confidence in the economic outlook and pulling back on shopping, eating out, and other activities. Spending on 30 million credit and debit cards, tracked by JPMorgan Chase, fell 7.4% earlier this month compared to a year ago. That marked a sharp drop from 2 weeks earlier. According to a University of Michigan survey, consumer sentiment also declined in early November and is down nearly 21% from a year ago. And retail sales rose just 0.3% in October, the smallest gain since stores reopened in April after a nationwide shutdown in March. The weak gain suggests that consumers began pulling back on spending even before many new restrictions on businesses were imposed. The government said recently the number of people who are continuing to receive traditional unemployment benefits fell to 6.4 million from 6.8 million. Some of that decline reflects more hiring, but it also indicates that many jobless people have used up their state unemployment aid, which typically expires after 6 months, and have transitioned to a federal extended benefits program that lasts 13 more weeks. Yet, According to a recent report from the Century Foundation, that extended benefit program is one of two federal supports that are set to expire at the end of this year, eliminating benefits for 9.1 million people. U.S. Congress has so far failed to agree on any new stimulus package for jobless individuals and struggling businesses. The cutoff of aid will sharply reduce income for the unemployed, force a further reduction in their spending, and perhaps weaken the economy. Of those programs is Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which made self-employed and contract workers eligible for unemployment aid for the first time. The PUA, the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, was established by a multi-trillion dollar aid package that Congress enacted in the spring. The second measure in the stimulus package provided the additional 13 weeks of benefits for unemployed people who have used up their state benefits. When those two programs expire on 26th of December, the Century Foundation estimates that 12 million people will lose their benefits. The report said about 2.9 million will probably transition to a state extended benefit program that can last from 6 to 20 weeks. The rest will lose their benefit that average about $320 a week nationally. The expiration of benefits will make it harder for the unemployed to make rent payments, to afford food, or keep up with utility bills. Most economists agree that because unemployed people tend to quickly spend their benefits, such aid is effective in boosting the economy. Cutting off benefits with so many people still receiving them would be unusually early compared with previous recessions. Currently, there are two active key government programs authorized by the Coronavirus Aid, Relief and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act, but both expire on 26th of December, the day after Christmas. One program is the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which provides unemployment aid to freelance and temporary workers. According to a study by the Century Foundation, if it expires, 7.3 million workers will lose their benefit. The study shows the other program is Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, which, if expires, would deprive 4.6 million workers of their needed income. Andrew Stettner, who co-authored the study with Elizabeth Pancotti, said, "Absent congressional action to extend CARES Act benefits, 26th of December will mark the end of one of the last lifelines available to millions of Americans in desperate need." Andrew Stettner added, "It will be a crippling end to one of our darkest years." The study projected that 2.9 million people will be able to continue receiving benefits from state-level programs called extended benefits, but that will require that states pitch in to cover half the costs in 2021. The expiration of the programs will leave millions of Americans without any unemployment benefits, which only cover a fraction of prior income. Another program, which added $600 a week to unemployment checks across the board, expired at the end of July. Andrew Stettner said, "People don't realize that most of the people collecting unemployment benefits now will be cut off on 26th of December, adding, "Most people will be going from that $200 to $300 a week to nothing. This will have a huge impact on families and on the economy. Meanwhile, several other pandemic-related programs will expire at the year-end. For instance, a moratorium on evictions and a program to provide forbearance on mortgages are also due to expire by the end of 2020. According to Oxford Economics senior economist Bob Schwartz, the end of aid programs would provide a real test for the U.S. economy. Bob Schwartz wrote in a report, "With infection rates spiking throughout most of the nation, so too are more restrictions being put in place, setting the stage for the unemployment lines to swell again." Adding, "Unless Congress extends jobless benefits, a vital source of income for this distressed segment of the population would be extinguished." The coronavirus pandemic, which hit in March, has left millions of Americans unemployed, and many more could lose their jobs as COVID-19 surges across the United States, sparking new restrictions from states and cities. The unbridled spike in recent weeks has brought new caseloads to over 150,000 a day on average. In the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the U.S. administration extended unemployment benefits to 99 weeks, and the additional aid lasted throughout 2013. When that program ended, about 1.3 million Americans lost benefits, a fraction of the number who would lose their aid at the end of this year. Elizabeth Pancotti, co-author of the Century Foundation report and a policy advisor at Employ America, a left-leaning think tank, said, "We're still down 10 million jobs since the pandemic began," she added. "We're heading into the winter. We're seeing additional business closures. Consumer demand is already falling. Cutting off benefits seems inhumane to me." In March and April, when the pandemic erupted in the United States, tens of millions of people applied for jobless benefit. Though many of them have been rehired or have landed new jobs, those who haven't found work began exhausting their 6 months of state aid as early as September. Most of them would then shift to the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, which provides 13 additional weeks of unemployment support. Yet the Century Foundation estimates that 3.5 million people will have used up all of those 13 weeks before the end of this year. An additional 950,000 people will have run out of the 39 weeks provided by the PUA program by then, too.